The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. Thanks for coming out tonight. I appreciate it. My name is Steve Inskeep. I work for Morning Edition from NPR News, and I'm here to introduce a colleague of mine tonight, ask a few questions, and take your questions as well. I'm delighted you've come out. Yeah, I see you. You're there. You're ready with a question. I've already heard from some people. Ready to go. This is going to be an exciting discussion, and you're a big part of it. It's an opportunity to hear Michelle's story and also share your own. I want to share, by way of introducing Michelle Norris, a story of something that happened to me this week. Maybe something like this has happened to you this very week or at some point in your recent history. I had some old family friends. I had my parents actually come in from out of town and bring an old family friend, a very sweet woman whom I've known all my life, to my house in Washington, D.C. They're from Indiana. This happened this week. And the family friend, this very sweet woman, begins telling a story. I can't recall how she got on this subject, but she began telling a story of her neighborhood in suburban Indianapolis. It was, I believe, an all-white neighborhood or almost entirely white neighborhood. And there's a woman who moves in, goes around the neighborhood, introduces herself. She's white. And she says, you know, every now and again you may see a police car at my house. But don't worry about it. Don't be concerned because I work at a jewelry store and sometimes somebody who's displaying jewelry accidentally wears it home and the police come and it's really nothing. Don't worry about it. The police actually did come a couple of times to this woman's house. The neighbors in this white neighborhood thought nothing of it. And then, according to my family friend in my dining room telling this story, people began calling each other throughout the neighborhood. There was a panic throughout the neighborhood. And one of the gentlemen in the neighborhood, I assume another older person, is calling my family friend and saying, there's an unidentified object moving through the backyards of our neighborhood. By unidentified object, the gentleman meant a black teenager. A young black man who went into the house of the woman who supposedly worked at a jewelry store, and that's why the police occasionally came. And suddenly the neighborhood was in a panic and people were calling the police. Why are teenagers going in and out of this woman's house all the time? The police investigated and discovered what may have been obvious from the beginning, that they believed this woman was dealing drugs. Now, what is remarkable to me about the story, many things are, actually, but one of the remarkable things about this story was that there is a woman who's white in a white neighborhood who is doing something that calls the attention of the police, but somehow everyone in the neighborhood is able to delude themselves that everything's okay until an African-American shows up. And then suddenly there's a panic and they discover there's a crime. The crime was that a white woman seemed to be dealing drugs to teenagers. I'm hearing this story in Washington, D.C., in a historically black neighborhood that is now very diverse, around the corner from a restaurant called Ben's Chili Bowl, which I used to really like. But for months, I could not go there in 2009 because the African-American president of the United States showed up to eat there, and suddenly there was a line of tourists around the block. And it's an astonishing world we live in where I can hear this appalling story in my dining room in the same neighborhood with Ben's Chili Bowl and in the same city where Barack Obama is president of the United States. Now, I tell you this because I have always been interested in questions of race and the strange stories that people tell. But I think that I have thought about these issues more seriously, more deeply, and in a much different way because I've been fortunate enough to collaborate with the woman we're about to hear from this evening. Michelle Norris, not too long ago, came to me, approached me, and asked me to collaborate with her on a project in York, Pennsylvania for National Public Radio, bringing together a diverse group of people in a fairly diverse city in the state of Pennsylvania, and talk about race, and just go on for hours and see what came out of people's mouths and see what we could learn about each other. It was an astonishing experience for those of us who participated, and it generated quite a response across the country. It grew into the book that Michelle has now written and published, The Grace of Silence, which you saw on the way in, and you'll see again on the way out. We're going to talk about that work and related issues and listen to your stories over the next hour and a half. First, I'd like you, though, to give a big hand to Michelle Norris, my colleague. Michelle, please come out. There we go. If I do this with the microphone, can everyone hear me okay? If I don't know how to work a microphone by now,
I was going to say that.
That would be a problem. Wow, it's great to be here and
talking
with you. Thank
you for that lovely introduction.
Well, I'm very proud of Michelle. I didn't tell you anything about her. I was so busy talking about myself. Michelle is a distinguished reporter who has worked at the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, ABC News, before coming to NPR in 2002. Many awards to her credit, even won DuPont Award, which is pretty much broadcasting's highest award or the highest available to radio.
Which we share.
Oh, yes, she won it in spite of working with me. The judges said we can't believe she worked with him, but nevertheless. How did you get started, Michelle, on the book that you now have produced, which wasn't precisely about everybody else's experiences with race, but your own?
It was supposed to be about everybody else's experience. When we finished the York Project, I wanted more. I thought that was magical radio, and I'm not trying to be a braggart in saying that. It wasn't magical because we had really high production values or it had lots of special effects or anything like that. It was a candid conversation about something that we often don't talk candidly about, race. And it made me think that there was this interesting hidden conversation out there, and I wanted to spend some time swimming in that conversation and listening to it and absorbing it. And my goal was to write a series of essays about how other people thought about race and talked about race in the run-up to it, in the wake of the election of President Obama. And when I started listening carefully to hidden conversations, I started hearing them everywhere, including, and I'm going to look in the front row, in my own family, because I have family members here, my sister-in-law and my niece and their husbands. And I started hearing things, Steve, that I had never heard before. Older people talking about things they'd locked away, suddenly going through this sort of historic indigestion and stories kind of bubbling up and coming out, and suddenly they were talking about things that made me realize, wait a minute, I thought I knew these people so well. Mm-hmm. There's like a big portfolio of their life that they have locked away in a closet that I know nothing about. And once I realized that, I had to try to open that door and figure out what was inside and to figure out why that door had been locked for so long.
Now, I happen to know, Michelle, and you just alluded to this, that you did not intend this book to be more than a sliver about yourself. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know if it was not only difficult to open some of these doors, but difficult to persuade yourself that you should.
There was nothing about this process that was easy. Writing, as you know, because you're working on a book right now, writing is hard. No matter what you're doing, writing is difficult. And I had tried to put together a plan to make it a little bit easier because I was doing this in a fairly short period of time. Mm-hmm. But once I realized that I had to take a different direction, and before I even realized that, I just started canoodling you know, I was supposed to be writing this book, but I spent so much time researching this other stuff. You know, the more I learned about my family, the more I just started digging and digging and digging and digging. And I was supposed to be doing this, but I found myself stuck in 1946 and wanting to go back to Birmingham and check more on something else. And so it wasn't that I made, I had an epiphany and I said, I'm going to write a memoir. It was more like I slid into it. And it was difficult because it meant that I knew I was going to have to take family members along a journey that they might not like. It was difficult because I was going to have to insert myself into the story. And it was difficult because I was going to leave kind of journalism as I understood it and do something completely different. It was a really big risk for me to take to write write memoir. And it's not a standard memoir in some senses. It really is a reported family memoir, but it's very different than what I do on the radio.
Now, you just alluded to the city of Birmingham, and you said 1946. Mm-hmm. What was the family event that really got you going, and how did you learn about it?
I have a hard time talking about this, and it's odd because I am on a multi-city tour. This is stop 16. And you would think that this would get a little easier by now, and it doesn't. It just, the more I talk about it, the more I learn about it from not just my family's perspective, but from the people I meet along the way who tell me about their family stories, and I realize that what I experienced is somewhat universal. What happened is I was having breakfast in Chicago with my Uncle Joe. You just met him recently.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful man.
He is the last surviving brother in my father's family. There were six of them. He's the only one left. And we were having breakfast, and he was upset this morning. We were in Chicago. He had spent the morning doing some work with voter registration. He'd been trying to get young people to register to vote, and he was mad because they just wouldn't pay attention. And he was having oatmeal, and he was fussing, and he was getting his neck exercises, and he was just talking about how they just don't know how hard that people fought so they could have these rights that they just take for granted. And you know your father was shot. No. I didn't know my father was shot. The man I knew was a postal worker, was a quiet fellow, was a by-the-book kind of guy, loved rules, the establishment of rules and the following of rules. And the idea that he was involved in an altercation where he was shot was stunning to me. And then to learn further that it was an altercation that involved a white police officer in Birmingham, Alabama in 1946 just made my head spin. There was nothing about the simple, you know, the simplest facts of the story that I heard from my uncle that made sense at all based on the man that I knew. And then further to that, to realize that, wait a minute, he never said a word about this to me, to my sisters. He'd never even told my mother about it, a woman he'd been married to for years. He'd never said a word about any of this.
How much did your Uncle Joe really know?
I don't know how much he really knew, but I know he didn't tell me that much. He told me just the bare facts, that my dad was shot in 1946 by a white police officer, that he had just returned to Birmingham from his military service in World War II, and there was really not much beyond that. He didn't have the date. He didn't have the day. He didn't know exactly where it was, and I had to use my investigative skills as a reporter to try to put this together and try to use my charms as a younger member of my generation of cousins to call upon the wider circle of aunts and uncles and cousins and family friends in Birmingham. And they hated this. They were so mad that I was asking these questions. I got one of two responses. It was either, oh, honey, now you know. As if I wasn't supposed to know, or it was people fussing at me and slamming doors and slamming down phones and treating me like I was an 8-year-old that was, you know, repeatedly asking.
Your own relatives were slamming the phone.
Yeah, I was hung up on more than once. I
can't imagine hanging up on her. Can you imagine hanging up on her?
I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but I am too old to be sent upstairs. And I was, you know, by people who just didn't want to talk about it. I mean, they treated me like I was an 8-year-old who didn't hear no, who was asking for a cookie that I was not going to get. But over time, the story started to trickle out, and I actually got lucky in that I found some people who were willing to talk about it, people who, by the way, many of them are gone. There are family members who I talked to in putting the story together who have since left this earth, which meant I captured their stories and their history just in time. And I got lucky in the sense that I found documentation, which is, you know, difficult to find in any kind of encounter with the police involving particularly a black man in 1946 because of police records. They just, you know, I found out that this stuff happened all the time, and they just didn't keep records.
Happened all the time. What was happening in 1946?
Well, this is the part of the story where you asked how difficult this was. This is where it really was vertigo producing, because I wondered, what did I slide into? I started this knowing only a small set of facts. Dad was wounded. It couldn't have been a serious wound because he lived. He lived until 1988 when he died. I knew when it happened, sort of, but not where it happened. Well, what I found out was that my father was wounded when he stood up, this mild-mannered postal worker, stood up to police officers when they tried to stop him from entering a building in 1946 in Birmingham, Alabama. Now, think about that. To stand up to police officers in 1946 as a black man, even as a black man who had just returned from military service, was to invite a special kind of trouble. The policeman's gun discharged, and he was wounded. It was a superficial wound. So he was fortunate, but he was fortunate in a larger sense. What I discovered was that in 1946, there were half a dozen returning black veterans who were killed by police officers in and around the city of Birmingham, reportedly in the first 6 weeks of 1946. My father was wounded in February. That so easily could have been him. What I learned upon further digging was that throughout the year in 1946, black veterans across the country were met with horrific violence. These were men who had put on the uniform and they had been transformed. They had come back to this country with a different set of expectations because they fought, they participated. You know, I say participated because they weren't always allowed to really fight in terms of combat. Many of them, like my father, wielded nothing more than spatulas. But they participated in the fight for democracy, and they wanted some of that when they came home, and they wanted jobs, and they wanted respect, and they wanted to vote. And they were met with a wall of resistance around the country. And across the country in 1946, black veterans who were seeking jobs and housing and voting rights were beaten and burned and maimed, blowtorched, castrated, lynched, blinded, killed, and blinded. And it was the blinding of a veteran in 1946 that so disturbed President Harry Truman that he decided to create the commission that ultimately led to the full integration of the armed forces. His name is Isaac Woodard. Now, I don't know how many of you know Isaac Woodard. Have you heard this name? In South Carolina, good for you. A gold star for you, because few people have heard of this name. Now, in 2010, few of us have heard of this name. In 1946, if you lived in this country, you would have known Isaac Woodard because it was big news all over the country. It was on the front page of newspapers, including here in Philadelphia. Songs were written about Isaac Woodard. Arlo Guthrie wrote a song. There was a Calypso song that was a big international hit. Orson Welles editorialized about Isaac Woodard on his Sunday evening radio program, Sunday night after Sunday night. This was big news, and yet few of us know this now. I consider all things every day on the radio. I thought I knew a lot. And this is something I did not know. And I was so frustrated by this. This was as frustrating to me, almost as frustrating to me as what I learned about my father, that this was going on all across the country, and this is this history that apparently is lost to us. And the more I started talking to veterans and to police officers of that time, to people who were involved in the voting rights, in the push for voting rights, and people who were involved in the effort to keep voting rights from people of color, who realize that this history is lost to us because everybody involved, everybody who touched it, just stopped talking about it. It was just too painful. So they just left it behind. And as a result, when we think about civil rights in this country, we have this convenient narrative that's sort of wrapped up in the mid to late 60s. And, you know, as I write in the book, it's as if Harriet Tubman rolled up to Martin Luther King and said, here's the baton, go for the gold, and sort of skipped over, you know, decades in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. And we just pick up in 1960s, in the late 1960s, with a narrative that's built around sort of a theme of overcoming oppression as opposed to the tyranny, or the terrorism of living through the Jim Crow era.
It's astonishing to learn about that. I mean, it's a sentence in a history book, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Harry Truman desegregated the armed forces in 1948. Why then? Now I know. I didn't know. Having read this book, I also learned other things that I guess I knew in the abstract, but had not thought about. The notion of why it was that more African Americans were welcomed into the armed forces in the first place during World War II.
Well, there were the big hair-raising discoveries in the writing of this book. I mean, the ones that, you know, really made my hair stand on end and you know, in some cases, jump out of my head. There are the smaller discoveries, though, that made the reporting a very rich and illuminating experience. And I think for those of you who read the book, and I hope a lot of you do, that it, I think, makes the reading of this book illuminating as well. Little things you learn. And I mean, one of them is that in the push for fuller participation in the armed services, one of the reasons that the U.S. military entertained this idea is because they were getting pressure from sort of interesting fronts, that they were getting letters from mayors and municipalities in small towns saying, please, you've got to start enlisting some of these black men because all the white men are leaving for war, and we have the situation where we have towns filled with white women and a lot of able-bodied black men. And this is spelled out in memos to Paul McNutt in the War Department. I'm saying, please, you know, we have this sort of social imbalance, and we're really uncomfortable about this. It was but one reason that they decided to move forward and to start to integrate the military. And there were other reasons as well. They decided that in the end, toward the end of the war, they decided that any kind of marginalization of men of color was material aid to the enemy. But it was deep into the conflict that they ultimately made that decision. For many men, particularly in the Navy and in the Marines, military service was basically a confirmation of their second-class status.
And so the veterans came home in particular to the South, African-American veterans, and were seen as what, uppity? Trying to rise above themselves, people were afraid of them. What was going on?
Well, you think about America in 1946. These are men who, if they were in the army and they were allowed to participate in combat, they had learned how to use guns. The idea of men of color having any kind of authority at that time was a highly radical notion. And at the same time, seeing these men in uniform and seeing their displays of patriotism also stirred the emotions of a larger public. I mean, there are some who were very uncomfortable with this push for equal rights, but there were some who were questioning the system because, wait a minute, America was involved in a war against human rights violations overseas, a war against fascism. Does the social structure in this country make sense given what we were fighting for over there? I mean, it was this period of questioning, and some of this I actually didn't include in the book. It was an author, a brilliant man named Stephen Carter. Some of you may be familiar with his work. He said, you really need to understand the time. Go to the pulpit. And I went and I found sermons of that time, and it was really helpful to help me understand what people were wrestling with. And a lot of people at that time, it was the beginning, again, the beginnings of the civil rights movement, not because of the push for civil rights, but also because of the questions that were being raised. And One of the things that's amazing to me about this group of men, in particular these veterans, and it's the reason why I chose the word grace in the title, is because they were marginalized in the military because of the strict codes of segregation. My father entered the military in 1943. He went to Robert Smalls, a training institution in Illinois, and he was almost immediately sent into the Cooks and Bakers program. And if you were a white enlistee, you followed a different path. For him, it meant he wore a C on his left sleeve, and that meant his service was basically about serving others. It didn't matter what kind of background he had, didn't matter what kind of IQ he had, that's what his military service was all about. And that was very common. So there were men who were marginalized in the military, and then when they returned home to discover that they fought for a country and actually loved a country that did not love them back. And they were marginalized further, and in some cases they were brutalized. Now, I never got a chance to talk to my father about this, but I've talked to many other veterans, and what I realized is that so many of them stopped talking about it, but they also made a decision as they moved forward. They left those stories behind like a garment that no longer fit them, and they decided to move forward more with hope than anger. I mean, people ask me, are you angry about this? And I look at how they responded. And they may have been angry, because it's hard not to be angry when you experience something like that. But in many cases, that anger wasn't manifest. And instead, so many of them decided to try to prove something to America by leading lives that were based, that were built upon utter rectitude, about being perfect, about being model citizens. Their cars were perfect. Their clothes were perfect. Their homes were beautifully maintained. You know these gentlemen when you see them. They're 80-year-old men. They walk with a certain pep in their step. They wear hats, even though they're long gone out of fashion. They don't wear fedoras anymore. They wear, like, Kangos now. They dress in a certain way. They tend to hit their words when they talk. There is a lot of diction involved. And they're saying, through everything they do, they're saying something. They're saying, I am a man. I am worthy of your respect. And if this is what it takes for me to get it, I am willing to do this. I will iron my pants so that you can cut your finger on the crease to show you that this is what I'm about. And that's where I went to that word grace, because it would have been so easy to see them take a different path, to be angry at the world, to be malcontents, to feed everybody around them a steady diet of frustration and complaint and rage. And they decided not to do that. And I think it was a decision. I really do. I think it was not just like it was innate. I think it was a decision. I have this image. Did you run track?
No.
If you ran track, you maybe have the coach's voice in your ear. If you want to win, you don't look sideways. You don't look, you know, to either side. And if you never look back. If you want to get to the finish line and if you want to get there first, you never, ever look back. And that's the image I have of these men sprinting, trying to get someplace better fast. And they just couldn't look back in order to do that.
He left the South.
Yeah. He left the South. All of his brothers left the South. My dad went to Boston, and then they all wound up in Chicago. They all lived together. There's a picture of them in the book that you learn something about the pride that these men have when you see that picture. They did what so many people did when they leave the South. There were photo studios all throughout the South and the west side of Chicago. My father was a postal worker, and most of his brothers either worked for the government or they were teachers. They were either postal workers or teachers. And they would get dressed up and go to the photo studio, and they looked like John Barrymore. You know, they are Nicholson brothers or something. They'd get really dressed up.
Suits.
Yeah, and little pins in their suits and everything. I mean, they were fine. And they would take these pictures, and then they'd mail them home. And they would say, you know, we're doing all right. We're doing all right. And that's what those pictures were all about.
He ended up in Minnesota. This is a man who, unknown to you, had been shot by a police officer in 1946. You've talked in general about how veterans were affected by their experience. You didn't get to ask your father, but you knew him and loved him about as well as anybody could. How do you think, what signs, looking back now, do you see in his life that you think grew out of that decision to leave the past in the past?
Well, there are some that are sort of existential, and, you know, the things I've talked about. My father, you know, my parents were also, my dad married a Minnesota girl. He married a woman from Minnesota. Hers was the only black family in a small town, and she wound up in Minneapolis, and she married my dad. And they kept a perfect house. And so I look back, and I grew up thinking they were just type A, you know, that they just liked things a certain way. And with the wisdom of my years, I now see that there was a form, there was a little bit of activism in that gardening. And there was a little bit of activism in the way that they made us dress all the time. And in the way they kept their cars and in the way we shoveled snow. Like before everybody else woke up in the morning, our yard was always shoveled, you know. There were other things, though. My father's gait, he had a little bit of a little bit of skip in his step that I grew up thinking was just sort of, you know, men of color sometimes walk with a little English in their walk. They kind of throw a little something-something when they kind of throw a leg out, and you know, and it's just a little sort of way of expressing themselves with the way they place one foot in front of the other. And all of my uncles had a little bit of this, but my father's was a little bit more pronounced. And I now know that it was something that was related to the wound that he got on his leg. The harder thing for me, Steve, is the question that I still wrestle with, and I thought I had put it to bed, and the more I talk about it, I realize that I haven't, was whether this was something maybe he tried to tell me and didn't. You know, when parents give a piece of themselves to their children and a piece of their history, we're pretty careful about what we tell our kids. We tell them what we're ready to tell them when we're ready to tell them, and then we tell them what we think they need to know. And we sometimes leave things out. And it's not because of, you know, dishonesty. It's not malevolent. In fact, just the opposite. It's because you want your kids to do well in the world. You want to send them out and you want them to soar. And so you don't want to weigh them down with your frustrations. And in my case, this is about race and my racial legacy, but that's, you know, that's true if you lived through the Holocaust or if you had poverty in your background or if you arrived in this country with not much money and no one wanted to talk about that. If you crossed over the border in the dark of night, that's a story that you might not want to share with your children. In my case, I wondered if Dad did want to share this, and if I just didn't make a place for him to do that. And that's a cross that I'll bear for the rest of my life.
You think there might have been that moment, quiet moment in the kitchen some morning after shoveling snow, that he might have been about to tell you a story and you went off in some other direction?
You know, maybe when I was a little bit older, in my 20s, possibly. I'm convinced that if he had lived long enough to see the history that we've experienced, to see these times, I think he would have talked. I think that because of the stories that are coming up in our family. I mean, when you get people of a certain age together now, they just talk about things. And a lot of that is because of what we've seen. I mean, you and I have talked about this notion of, you know, keep your eye on the prize. Is, you know, it's, you hear it in song lyrics, and there's PBS documentaries about this. This was just something we heard all the time. You know, you got to keep your eye on that prize. You've got to either get to work twice as hard or you're going to get half as hard. I mean, it was just all the time. And when you're little, you wonder, well, is that prize, is it sparkly? Is it going to have a bow on it? Is it going to be something that I can rip, will have my name on it? And then you get older and you realize it's not promised to you. It's not like the gifts under the tree at Christmas. It's just a concept. And you're supposed to strive toward it. And you might never touch it because it's way over there and it's past a mountain range. And you have to go through boiling oil to get there. And when you do, there's still the hot sands of time. And you can, you know, you just might never get there. And then this past couple of years, what happened is with this ascension of a black candidate and then the election of a black president, even members of my family who don't much agree with Barack Obama, who aren't members of his political party, turn on the radio and hear a man's voice and hear a little something in that voice, or pick up the newspaper and see a man of color sitting at a really big desk in the Oval Office who looks like their grandson, and it's like the platelet shifted, and suddenly they exhaled. And when they exhaled, all these stories started coming out. And so if my father, I think, had lived long enough to see some of this, he might have gone through this period of historic indigestion, and I may have been able to capture some of that from him. But in his case, it was too late.
Well, I have two things to say. One is, if he was around for you to question him today, you would have gotten everything. Because I know how you ask questions.
Yeah.
The other thing actually is about asking questions and listening. Why was it important for you to go searching for the white police officer who shot your father?
Because I had to know what life was like on the other side. I mean, this is where being a journalist really informed what I did. I needed to know the whole picture. I wanted to know, what did they tell their kids? You know, how did they talk about their history? And I wanted to understand what it was like to work in a department that's been defined by two words, Bull Connor. When you think of the Birmingham Police Department, what do you think about? You think about Bull Connor. Did they all think like Bull Connor? Did they all like him? What do they think about being defined by this guy who's sort of like the boogeyman of, you know, race in America? And so I really wanted to find them, and I wasn't able to find the officers that were in the Pythian Temple that night, but I was very fortunate to find someone who was on the force and was willing to talk, because finding those two things was actually difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really important to me because, and this as a journalist is something that has always interested me, is finding people who are in the margins of the story, who aren't, you know, in the center of the frame. Have you heard from the officers who actually, you know, held on to the dogs or were there when the water cannon were turned on peaceful protesters? What was it like if you enforced Jim Crow laws and then all of a sudden the laws changed and the world shifted under your feet? How did you order your steps after that? What's life like for you now? And I was fortunate that I found this cop. This is too good. I have to share this. Named Aubrey Justice. I mean, no kidding. And at that point, I thought, okay, I made the right decision. This is kismet. I was meant to follow this story. And then he had a partner.
Did you refer to him as Officer Justice?
I did. I did. I talked to him the week before last, and I just love saying Officer Justice. Is Officer Justice home? And he had a partner, by the way, when he was a young police officer named Crook. So they were Crook and Justice. But he was fantastically giving of his time. And once that spigot opened, he had a lot to say. He really, and no one had asked. You know, that was the thing. No one had, you know, he was thankful to be able to tell his side of the story because he felt that he wasn't even a footnote. That when people, it was exactly that. When people think about cops in Birmingham, they had a fairly calcified idea of what a cop in Birmingham was like, and it was based on one man who ran the show, you know, several decades ago.
I'm about to take some questions from the audience and hear some stories from the audience, but I do want to follow up on that. So, if you got your questions, get them ready. As you talk about asking the question of the people who held the water cannons. What's coming to mind for me is that famous experiment in which I took college students, I think, and put them in a room and told them, when you turn this dial, you're torturing someone in the other room.
Yeah.
You start hearing someone screaming. And huge numbers of students just turned those dials because somebody was telling them to do it. It's amazing what people do and what people are persuaded to do. And how
can I just say something, though?
What?
Because one of the things I realized, and maybe I didn't make this point as strongly as I should have in the book, but I hope that you will understand it when you read it, is that the more I learned about these police officers,
mm-hmm.
the more I realized that their lives were so much like the lives of my grandparents and their sons in Birmingham, Alabama, that there is this tremendous bifurcation in society, and the black folks were kept over here and the white folks were kept over there. And yet the more I learned about these police officers, they lived in little wood frame bungalows that looked just like the one that my grandparents lived in. They played the same games with their kids. They listened to some of the same music. They sang the same songs at their Baptist church, which was around the corner from our Baptist church, because my father was Baptist. My mom's Catholic, but my father's Baptist. And if the color line had not been so, you know, so wide and so high, they may have seen something of each other in themselves. It reminds me of a story I did for NPR years ago where I interviewed the marshals that actually escorted children to school. Again, at the margins, no one had talked to them, and I wanted to find out what life was like for them. And one described how, and many of those marshals were Southerners. They were chosen because they were Southerners, because they thought that they could sort of deal with the guff that they would receive from the white community in the South. And he told me how he would send money home, and every time he went home, he would be very angry because his wife would take part of their hard-earned money and purchase china. Not even china. It was like dishes from the grocery store, when the grocery store used to sell like a set that you could get at the grocery store. And every month she would get another one, and then she would display them in the dining room. And this really irked him because he thought, you know, they should be saving money for something other than dishes. And when he went to get one of the little girls that he had to escort, they asked him to come in the house, and he really didn't want to go, and she insisted. And so he went in the house, and he's waiting for the little girl to get ready, and he looks over in the dining room, and he sees the chiffon robe, and he sees dishes. And they're the same dishes. And he said at that moment he realized that man's wife is probably spending his money on those dishes. And I bet he's as mad about this as I am. And for him, that was his aha moment. Like, these are not just black people who are over there. These people are, they have hopes and dreams. They have pride. She is as prideful as my wife is. I mean, and that, he said that changed everything for him. And that day when he took that little girl to school, he told her, "You take my hand." And that's, you know, that, those things, if I can share things like that with you, that means that I'm doing something, and that's why I had to know what life was like on the other side.
Well, you sell yourself short by saying that was just professional or journalism to do that. I think it's something special to listen, even in that difficult circumstance, to someone who was on the other side. Michelle Norris is going to be here for how long? An hour? Another hour? Something like that? A little while longer. I would like to begin to take questions from the audience here. Questions, stories, comments, concerns, outrage about the interviewer this evening, anything you would like. If you'd like to ask a question, I'd ask that you stand. The microphone, I believe there are microphones in the aisles. The microphone will come to you. Raise your hand. I'll call on somebody. And there we go. You get to go first. If you would please say your name and where you're from. I assume most of you are from Philadelphia, but go ahead anyway. Say where you're from.
Sure.
In Philadelphia.
Thank you. My name is Sade Olani Pekun Lewis. I live in Philadelphia, although I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York, and my parents are from West Africa. When you shared the piece about Birmingham, I lived in Birmingham for 3 years. I worked for the mayor, and I actually became friends with a number of the police officers because one of my staff was dating one of the police officers. So I had an opportunity to actually go on drive-alongs and go to their homes and go to the neighborhoods. And prior to that, I left Philadelphia to go live in Birmingham with the same expectations about the race issues, Bull Connor issues. And when I had a chance to live and work with these folks, I realized, as you shared, that these folks are no different than us. And unfortunately, they were being painted with the same brush from the 1940s. Mm-hmm. And so I really appreciate you sharing that. I'm looking forward to reading that in the book. My parents are immigrants that moved. My father's from Nigeria. My mom is from Jamaica. And they had different sets of race issues than, I would say, black Americans did. Their issues were surrounded around the fact that they were immigrants in the 1950s and late 50s, early 60s, and had similar values like your parents did. They sort of were, I thought, A-type. You know, my parents, like, you got to go to school. You're going to be a doctor. You're going to be an engineer. You know, certain things had expectations for their children. We didn't become doctors and engineers, but I think we've done well, my brother and I. And in hearing your stories, I'm getting a better understanding. My father's also deceased. My mom is still around and won't talk about her experiences. And we've learned a lot about our dad since he died, how he got here. He came here. They deported him. He came back. And so now I'm also, again, as you were talking this evening, beginning to have a much better appreciation of why they're not talking. It drives my brother and I to no end why my mom won't talk to us about her experiences, and that's probably why, because we got little snippets about the fact that it was rough when she came here, she was a domestic, she had horrible experiences from our family members, not from her, and she won't talk about it when we ask her about that.
So consider that reconnaissance. This is, you know, it's difficult. You can't force someone to tell your story, but I'll just share a few suggestions. I mean, I called this book The Grace of Silence, but I hope more than anything it encourages people to have discussions and to consider their own histories and how much they know about the people they raised, who raised them, and to think about your own hidden histories. A couple things. Food. When we did the conversation in New York, we ate before we talked. We sat down and shared a meal together, and it just slid us immediately into a comfortable place. Food always helps. Did your mother like... Okay, but what does she really love? Is there, like, something that just makes her swoon? Okay, so you make her a pot of good steaming curry chicken and take her back to that place and then just, like, let food get her in a comfortable place. If you can't get her to talk about life, then knock on the side door. So she might not want to talk about her life on the job, but ask her about, you know, when you went on a Saturday night, pick the year, what did you wear? What were you listening to? What did you, you know, what were the date, when you started dating Dad, what was that? Get her to talk about the era, and then maybe she'd slide into the circumstances of life in that era. And the last thing I'll say is if you have any children at your disposal, use them shamelessly. Now, my niece is here in the front row with her husband, and she knows children can get away with stuff that we can't get away with. They have this curiosity that is at once innocent and very demanding. Well, why were things like that? You know, what, you put up with that? I mean, they can say things. I can't say that, but they can. And then what happens is they somehow break the ice. My young children were very helpful, particularly with my mother, who is still living. She's an amazing woman, and she's been through quite a year because her nosy daughter has gone rooting through the attic of family history. And there were a lot of things that she really did not want to talk about. I had to wait her out, and the kids helped me get her to a place where she was willing to tell her stories because they would ask her questions, and then she would talk to them. And then over time, she was talking to me through the kids. She knew I was listening. She knew I was writing stuff down, but she wouldn't look at me. She would talk to the kids, and she'd have this sort of innocent conversation with them, and somehow that was signaling to me that she was ready. And I think part of the reason that kids are helpful also is because it's history, it's legacy. It's, you know, parents want to, they may not want to talk about these things, but they do want. Legacy is important to people. Oral history is important to people. And I'll say one last thing. You have an opportunity to do this coming up because Dave Isay, who runs the StoryCorps Project, you hear them every Friday on Steve's program, A Morning Edition. He is championing a holiday called the National Day of Listening. It is the day after Thanksgiving. It's when you're often with your family anyway, watching lots of football, eating lots of leftovers. His suggestion is that maybe instead of running to the mall, that you sit down with family members since you're all in one place and get their histories and, if possible, record it. I have no recordings of my father. My children will never hear his voice. And I live in a world of audio, and that's a very sad thing for me. So if you can record that history and if you can capture that, it is an incredible gift. Thank you.
One other suggestion for you is to buy many copies of The Grace of Silence. Unobtrusively put them in your mother's house all over the place. Wait a month and she'll pick one up and read it.
Letters also, you know, because that generation still writes.
Did you feed questions to your children to ask your mother?
You know, you've met my daughter. I don't need to feed her questions. You know, she just is highly inquisitive. And, no, I didn't have to. I didn't have to. I just, you know, listened, and then I'd come in the other side door and then go back and start to fill that in. But she really did prime the pump.
Other questions from the audience? Yes, ma'am, right behind the microphone there.
Hi, I'm Joan Chinitz, live in Fort Washington, which is right nearby. And it's really not a question, but my husband and I happened to be able to catch a little bit of the PBS show yesterday on religion in America. And if I heard correctly, Andy Young was describing the march in Birmingham and said when the protesters kneeled, when they knelt down and they started to chant and softly sing, it did something to the Birmingham police. And he said it was like the parting of the Red Sea all over again. They just let them pass.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if that was the actual protest where the dogs and the water cannon were unleashed, because there were several protests that, was almost a 3-week period. And the students mainly came from Parker High School, which is actually, it was the only high school for Negro students in Birmingham. It was a high school that my father and all my uncles attended. And what we now know, because of a good deal of history that's been written about the period, is that there were deep divisions in the department. And Bull Connor was actually on his way out. He had one foot out the door at that point. Birmingham was a boom town during the war years. The city fathers, they called themselves the big mules. They were very worried about international contracts. Atlanta was really overtaking Birmingham as the center of commerce. And Bull Connor and all that he represented was starting to hurt the city's fortunes. I mean, literally its fortunes, its business interests. And so there were deep divisions in the government circles and in the business circles. I wouldn't be surprised if the voices of children caused, you know, police officers who were there to arrest them to give them pause. But we know that many of those children were arrested, and many of them spent days and nights in jail, and that was the intent. And there were divisions on the other side. I mean, not everybody in Birmingham was comfortable with the use of children. Not everybody in Birmingham, including my father, was comfortable with outsiders coming in and leading those marches. I mean, he would note that Martin Luther King was not a son of Birmingham, and that was a really important distinction to him. And again, the notion that they would put children in harm's way, not everybody at the time was comfortable with that, even though it's now looked upon as sort of a heroic era of history. There's a lot of consternation and deep conflict about that at the time.
I want to encourage more people over here to consider questions. Michelle's family, I'm expecting a brutal question out of you guys pretty soon. And I know this young woman over here who spoke with me earlier this evening. You have a question. We're going to get to you in a minute. How about this gentleman over here while we're waiting? We're going to come to you next, ma'am.
My name's Richard Malkin. I'm from Northeast Philly. My question is a logical evolution of what you were just discussing, but I was wondering how your father and his contemporaries felt about the more militant strains in the civil rights movement of the 60s, such as black nationalism, black Muslims, Stokely Carmichael, things like that, versus Martin Luther King and nonviolence.
My father he had very complicated views on this. He loved Martin Luther King, but as I said, he was uncomfortable with the role he took and the credit he took for all that happened in Birmingham. Birmingham, even though something terrible happened to him there. Birmingham was an important place for him. And that is one of the aspects of the story that is most befuddling to me, is how deeply he loved the city where he was shot. He sent me back every summer when I was a kid. He went back constantly, and his parents lived there, and it could be just to check on them, but there was something else that, you know, he really felt a strong tie to Birmingham. So he was conflicted about that. He was very interested in Malcolm X. And it's funny, in his effects after he died, he was a postal worker, and they have the wanted posters, you know, in the post office. And I found this Angela Davis wanted poster that he must have, like, taken down from the wall and, like, you know, spirited home, which I still have now.
Explain who Angela Davis
is. And Angela Davis is, you know, for those of you who were really young, Angela Davis was a freedom fighter, was seen as Soul Sister number one. For a period of time, she had, you know, a big afro and big ideas about American society and what was wrong with American society, and was willing to speak out and speak up and paid a price for that. And she was in Birmingham. And maybe that's, you know, that explains that. But as he got older, there were certain things that were interesting to me. Like, he started to carry this afro pick that had, like, the fist, you know, and he wanted to borrow mine, and it would, like, poke out of the back of his pants, you know, because it was this postal worker that had this little fist, you know, out of the back of his pants. So, you know, it was a time where he was probably wrestling with some of this, and God, I wish I could talk to him about that. You know, that's why I love talking to my Uncle Joe, who is, you know, the last of the brothers, because he has lots of views, and it's, you know, it's they've lived quite a life. They've seen quite a lot, and they've seen things that for them would have been like trying to touch the sun. You know, they've lived it in their lives, and I don't know if I've answered your question quite clearly, but I don't have an easy answer, because I think his views, based on what I remember and what I did talk to him about and what I observed, His views sort of evolved over time. He became sort of quietly militant, and I realized that. And, you know, and as I said, some of the things he quietly did were sort of small acts of militancy in his own way. And I didn't understand that, because maybe I shouldn't say this. I don't need to tell you how old I am, but in the 70s.
When you were four.
Yeah. I thought that activism had a certain look and smell and feel to it, that it was all about, you know, sort of in your face, act out loud, you know, be loud and be heard and be seen and be in your face. And I now realize that that activism and militancy can take several forms. And sometimes it's just doing what no one expects of you. And sometimes doing what no one expects of you means being excellent every day.
Hmm. Okay, ma'am, you've been waiting to unload on us.
Actually, I was thinking of something. Oh, so my name is Beverly Penn. I live in Philadelphia, but I'm from New York originally. And actually, I was thinking, listening to you speak, about soldiers coming back from World War II. My father wasn't able to serve because he had contracted polio as a child, but my uncle served, and he was in the last corps of cavalry that rode on horseback during World War II. And when he came back to the States, was interested in doing something in terms of, you know, horseback riding. I mean, he was a horseman up until he passed away. And, of course, the conditions in the United States at that time, then when he came back, he didn't suffer quite the way that men in the South did. But I think there's an expectation living in the northern states that things would happen in that there'd be more opportunities in the north than there were in the South. And I was finding it interesting listening to you talk that the distinction between southern black men of that time period and northern black men of that time period and how they handled those same types of those same questions. You know, the issue of excellence was always there. My parents were very much like that. Things had to be a certain way. We definitely have China displayed and all that sort of thing. And whether one, how one person internalizes it and handles it quietly and another person internalizes it and handles it in a more difficult, more different, more aggressive kind of way. My dad was pretty angry about the whole thing. But my question, which I had asked Mr. Inskeep earlier this evening, was when you were having the conversations in York, my friend and I, we've been talking about this, had listened to both of the programs, and we wanted to know why when you got to sort of an uncomfortable place in the discussion, nobody pushed the speaker a little bit further and maybe asked what seemed to us to be an underlying issue or question in their answer. So, for example, the lady who said that she was on, I think, riding on the bus or something, and every time she would pass a black man in town, she would be a little anxious and nervous and afraid that they were going to do something to her. And it just seemed like there was another place that you could have gone with the questioning there, maybe push them to a place that was a little more uncomfortable for them to see if there was another, something else that they wanted to say or some other feeling that they wanted to express in those conversations that you had.
I'll take this, and Steve, I think we should both take this. I actually, that was Leah Moreland. And
we need to explain, did most people hear this series, by the way? No? People are saying no? Yeah, explain. We're talking to this room full of people in York, Pennsylvania.
Go ahead.
Go.
There are 15 of them. They represent the diversity of York. And we ask them simple questions. Do black people make too much of race? Do white people underestimate their privilege? When you hear Sarah Palin talk about Joe Sixpack, what does Joe Sixpack look like? Is he Asian? Simple questions like this. And in this case, that was the third or the second trip. That was after the election of Barack Obama?
It
was before.
The cases in which Leah Moreland said astonishing things would be all of them.
Right. But I'm thinking she was the one. She really spoke with
passion.
She was quiet. And this goes to, she was, I remember, I just can't remember which trip it was, but she was talking about something she was worried about. She said, it was a second trip. She said, I worry that if Barack Obama is elected, there's going to be payback. And she was really foothitched by this. She was really concerned that something would happen, and she talked about growing up at a time where when she walked down the street, a person of color coming down and the other way would have to step up the sidewalk. I remember that in Birmingham. I remember that time, you know, living like that. She said that she was afraid that the opposite would happen, that if black people coming down the street were coming down the street, that she might have to step off, that they were. And I remember asking her at the time, who's they? And letting her explain who she thought they were. I felt in that moment that she didn't need to be judged by me, but that she should have a place to speak her mind, and that the other people in the room, my role, I saw our role, to guide the discussion and let people in the room talk amongst themselves, and we guided that. Now, I could take another approach, maybe a more BBC approach, and be a little bit more pugilistic, but my goal was to let people get to a place where they would talk honestly and where they wouldn't move into a defensive posture. I think there's great value in that. It's another reason that I wanted to talk to people on the other side of the proverbial color line, because if we in this country are so interested in having this so-called honest conversation about race, it means you're going to hear something that's going to make you uncomfortable. I mean, there are a lot of different views. And if you want to really get honest, we've lived through a painful history here. We're in a better place, not a perfect place, but there's a lot of pain associated with this topic and a lot of confusion and different views. And so if you want to have an honest conversation, it means that you're going to have to hear somebody out. And you might not change their mind, they may not change yours. But I think there's value in listening to someone. And so that's why I didn't feel it was necessary to push her, to goad her, but more to draw her out so that we were clear about what it was that she was trying to say. That's what I thought, Steve.
There was a postscript to this story as well, because Leah Moreland, this woman who was perhaps the most explicit of the white participants, after she'd been on NPR a couple of times saying some pretty wild things, got a call from, was it a Dutch?
Yes, I think it was Dutch.
Okay, Dutch television crew. And they wanted to come out and interview her. And she started asking her fellow participants, up to 15 people who were in this group, if they had gotten a call from the Dutch television crew, and they hadn't. And she realized, after talking, I think, with her minister, that she was going to be interviewed by the Dutch television crew because they needed somebody to stand in as the crazy racist white nut job. And that was her. And I don't know if that changed her view of anything or just maybe made her a little more careful. She didn't talk to the Dutch crew. But I think there was value in listening, in airing that out. And I would suggest, I'm going to disagree with you and also agree with you. I'm going to disagree with you about the interview because I think that there was value in just listening and let that tape play. I think we played, it's got to be the longest soundbite in the history of national
including the ums and the ahs, because you needed to hear her work it out.
Let's just listen. Where I think I'll agree with you is that I think that in broader conversations in our daily lives, when somebody starts saying something that seems awfully weird, how do you deal with that? How do you respond to that? Do you sit there politely and quietly, or do you talk about it? And if so, what is your goal in talking about it?
Or do you say, I can't believe you just said that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a tough one. I remember this is something we discussed in the car on the way to York for one of these discussions. I get up every morning. I go to work. I raise my hand for a taxi at 3:30 in the morning or whatever, and somebody stops eventually, and I get in the cab. And one day I get in a cab with this white fella, and he's very white, white hair, guy from Virginia. He told me so. And the first thing when I get in the cab, he says, boy, I'm sure glad to see you. I could see from a block away you were a white guy. I was really relieved to get you, which made me feel really good about paying him his $7. But I didn't say anything to that guy. Should I have? Should I have had an argument with him or at least asked him a question? Why is it? Do you think the black man is going to rob you? What is it you... I mean, you know, and I think that you raise a very fair question, which is, how do you deal with that situation? How do I deal with my old family friend that I talked about at the beginning, who's in my dining room, granted quoting a neighbor, but, you know, who described a black man as an unidentified object? What am I supposed to do with that? How do I advance the dialogue there somehow? And that's tough, because if I feel like if I just yell at somebody, they'll just deny everything and go, oh, yeah, I didn't mean it that way, or whatever.
You know, this is a topic that people get. I was just in, what city was it? Seattle, talking with someone who said that his, is a white, older white man, and his son plays sports and has a lot of young black men who are his friends. And he says, I can't talk to them. I'm so afraid I'm going to say the wrong thing. And I thought, really? But then the more he went on, it was clear this was real. I mean, he was sweating, and his body was sort of twisted. I mean, this was really hard for him. He said, I just am so afraid that I'm going to call, like, Rakim. And I thought, well, I might do that, you know? I mean, you know, but he was really upset about this. And you know, in the end I said, why don't you start with hello? And then from there, you know, what position do you play? And then from there, you know, just take it like one step at a time. And he's like, really? Really? Is it that easy? And sometimes, I mean, I'm not going to say that talking about race is easy, but sometimes it's that granular. Sometimes it really can start at that
Although
point.
You, there was a little reception at our public radio station, WHYY, earlier, and you said something very interesting, because someone was alluding to the speech on race that President Obama gave here in Philadelphia during the campaign. And you asked why would not a prominent white politician give a speech on race?
Actually, I said, I'm waiting for the day, because I think it would be really interesting.
And maybe we've answered the reason. It's scary, given the reason. I mean, I think that any politician who's not forced to address that question would just dodge it.
Yeah.
Because it is a tough topic. It's a tough topic to know how to talk about it and to work your way around it.
You know, but I'm going to quote David Isay again, because I think he's a really wise man. His the motto for StoryCorps is that listening is an act of love. What York taught me is that listening is an act of courage. And it demonstrates great courage if you can hear somebody out. When Leah said these things, what you didn't hear on the radio was the sound of necks snapping. You know, really, I mean, in the room, did she really just say that? Did she? But the conversation continued. You know, if she had said that on cable television, sorry, but true, it would be repeated over and over again. There'd be finger wagging and all things. In this case, someone else, you know, Michael, I think, was the one who said, why would you have to step off the sidewalk? And then the conversation continued. And the two women who were at Loggerheads, Leah and Margie, every time we got together for one of these conversations, at the end of the night, the two of them were huddled up in the corner with cake, you know, talking to each other. And we, the last time, we had to, like, kick them out of the room.
Yeah.
Because we were ready, we had work to do, and they wanted to continue talking.
Yeah, it's true. Let's continue talking here. Right in the front row, ma'am. Please go ahead.
Excuse me, we are at time, so we've got time for one more.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, this is horrible. You know what? But hold on. Before you do, maybe we're going to try two. We're going to abuse that. Does the fam? Do you have any questions for Michelle?
Do we have any questions?
Yes.
Oh.
Everybody here's a relative of Michelle, right?
Yes. Thomas, Vonda, T.T. Carnesha, and oh.
Oh, okay. Okay. Wait for the microphone. And I'm going to get your question. I'm going to abuse our host here, and we're going to do one extra question. All right.
I keep repeating the title.
Stand up, please, and say your name.
Oh, sorry. Hi, I'm Carnesha Kwashi.
Newlywed.
Newlywed. And I keep repeating the title of the book in my head, The Grace of Silence, The Grace of Silence, and just reading the acknowledgments. Whenever you're at Uncle Broderick and Aunt Michelle's house, when we say grace, she takes a special moment out and she says a little silent prayer to herself. And I've been asking her for years, what are you saying?
I'm never going to
And she's never going to tell me. But I have a question. We're the first generation, your kids and Aunt Karen and everybody, to live outside of segregation. What do you think the grace of silence will look like for us, being that we're the first generation outside of segregation, living outside of segregation, and we've actually been able to witness the first African-American president? What do you think our stories are going to look like from this point on, being that we have another story to tell? We have your stories and mom and dad's and grandparents' stories, but what will our stories look like in terms of what is kept from us and what is also revealed to us, and how we're going to define these great moments in our society, in our history.
So the American society we were just talking about, this is no longer binary. We talk about race, it's usually black and white. Your tapestry is going to be more multi-hued, and I think that's really cool. We want you to soar, and just as my father and my mother wanted me to soar, and so they didn't want to put boulders in my pockets by weighing me down with their pain. But I think you need to have pebbles in your pocket. I think you need to know your history, because it keeps you grounded. And so even though I benefited from the grace of silence, I hope that you practice the grace of silence in a different way, in that you listen to those of us who are willing to tell you your stories and give you something of your history because it's your history. It's your birthright.
Last question, right here, quickly.
I'm from Philadelphia. I'm from Philadelphia. My name is Damaris. This is your 16th city. How did we do in Philadelphia? But what are you hearing, and who comes to your meetings? And Steve, do you travel with?
I wish I could take him with me all the time, but I'm off the air until January, and I don't think they'd give both of us up, although it would be an enticing idea. We should think about that. You rock in Philadelphia. This has been a great conversation. This has been a great time to be listening to America, and that's been one of the great benefits of the tour. What happens is people often come to hear my story, but they talk about theirs, and that's what I love. It's a conversation. I have a website associated with the book. It's michelle-norris.com. There's a Your Story section of the website where people can post their own stories, things that they've heard, things that they've experienced, their own travails with their own family, you know, trying to unpack their own family legacy. And I leave you with something to, you know, I guess it's food for thought. Race is a four-letter word that is tough for us to talk about, but maybe if you just reduce your thoughts to six words, you can think about what that, you know, your experiences, your views, your thoughts, your triumphs, your laments, anything you might have to say, just one sentence, six words. And you can either leave them with us tonight or you can email them to me and I will occasionally post them on the website. So this has been stop number 16 will have a special place for me. It's been a great
I'm glad one. You came out on a rainy evening. Stand up. Thank you very much. Do remember the book is outside. I read it. It's awesome. It's great.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.